Chief Justice Steele, Justice Berger, excuse me, Justice Berger and Justice Jacobs. As a personal aside, good morning. As a personal aside, I was going to say and be politically correct that it's a pleasure being here today. And as I thought about it, talking to Kim, who was driving me down, I said, you know, it's not really a pleasure. It's kind of scary. And we talked about why when I get down here I feel out of control and nervous, and always have and probably always will. And it's like being in front of three people who you know no more than you do, who had more time to consider it and have had a lot of assistance in doing so. So to the extent that I stumble over my words in these cases, that is the reason why. My argument, I'm trimming the sails, so to speak, and my argument will resolve itself to three different areas. One will be the constitutional area, which includes the attack on the statutory scheme, and secondly, the due process aspect of the indictment. The second and the main focus of my argument is the Probst unanimity argument. And the third argument that I had, this insufficient evidence, I'm withdrawing because I realize I looked at it too narrowly and simply focusing on the masturbation aspect of the statute. I'm embarrassed to say that I'm here on a plain error standard, and that's not good. And it's in two different areas. Both the unanimity and the attack on the indictment are based upon my having to establish plain error. And I suggest that under the circumstances, plain error is established. As I read the transcript last night, I was impressed with the performance in the courtroom, and I was unimpressed with how this jury instruction conference never touched upon Probst. And I likened it to a football game where all the passes are thrown well, the blocks are executed perfectly, it's 2 minutes left in the game, the strong side safety is not on the field, and the quarterback calls a plunge into the line. At the end of the case, this should have been brought up, this unanimity situation. This is a classic situation, and it wasn't done. State versus Lew says that the Delaware Constitution gives an unqualified right to a litigant to have a unanimous jury, and that unanimity is based upon everybody agreeing upon the same set of circumstances causing the same violation of the law. In this particular case, there were three categories of potential prohibited sexual acts vis-a-vis John Kenya: masturbation, sexual contact, and or lascivious display of the genitals. With regard to Blaze, there were only two because masturbation was not, there was no evidence of masturbation. And it was the latter two of lascivious exposure of the genitals and sexual contact. The standard set out in Probst is whether or not there is a genuine possibility that a conviction may have occurred as a result of different jurors making different factual findings. It is certainly within the realm of genuine possibility that some of the jurors would say vis-a-vis John, I think suggesting to him that it's a good idea to masturbate, that is a prohibited sexual act, but I'm not so sure, given his credibility issues regarding all of those bets that he talks about and then still goes to these faraway places and is alone with the man, I think he made that up. Or, with regard to Blaze, yes, I do believe that he did put his hand underneath his pants and he's attempting sexual contact, but I'm just not so sure that skinny dipping under those circumstances was a lascivious display of the genitals. There is no way that the state can refute any kind of mix and match of the three parameters vis-a-vis John. There is no way that the state can defend a mix and match of a two-way mix with regard to Blaze. So this court is left with a genuine possibility that that jury came into a mix-and-match situation which would offend Lew and which would offend the Delaware State Constitution. With regard to the constitutional issue.
Well, Mr. Hurley, clarify one thing for me. Did the state rely on different sets of facts in the same trial to obtain the conviction, or were they steadfastly going on one factual track?
Well, their argument is not evidence. The evidence supports sexual bets for, nudity bets, there's evidence of that. There's touching of the body, which is a sexual contact. And then with regard to John, there's masturbation. They're all in there. The jury was not given any definition or any instruction or guidance which is a prohibited sexual act and which they could focus upon.
I understand that, but did the state focus upon one or more than one?
What?
In other words, did the state create the confusion that you're claiming that the court failed to correct sua sponte?
Now, the confusion, I believe, thinking this over the years there's been an evolution. Historically, when Justice Steele came into the bar, there was always a two-wit, which specified exactly what the state was alleging. Then, as a result of evolution, I guess...
If we're going to be historical, I have to suggest to you that I came to the bar before he did.
Well, I came the same year he did, so I felt comfortable not insulting him because I'm just as old. Thank you.
Or as young.
Thank you. I think that became surplusage because the state got locked into things. So now we just have the state indicting these prohibited sexual acts and leaving it up to a bill of particulars. And in this particular case, stupidly as it turns out, I had a contact with the prosecutor who has since taken off the case, and he indicated to me at that time, because I called him, I said, how am I supposed to defend this stuff? And he gave me what each count was, and he mentioned masturbation, so I went off on this as masturbation. The confusion is caused...
Can I explain the notes on the indictment that's in the appendix?
Yes.
That was your, what the military would call specifications of the respective charges, is that correct?
Yes. As a simultaneous conversation, and I didn't realize that had been in there until I saw it.
Was that before trial?
Yes, that's shortly after indictment. And it was with that conversation that I then filed a motion attacking this, focusing on this masturbation aspect of it, ignoring numbers 9 and 11 of what is a prohibited sexual act. I should have filed a bill of particulars, but we had a relationship, and he's never backed off on that before. So as I went into the trial, our primary focus was the masturbation aspect of it, although the other things are clearly part of the statute. So when the state...
My question is, what was the state's focus, and did it shift, or was it consistent?
Well, I found out the state's focus in their closing statement, because during the course of the... I did not see the opening here, did not read the opening to see exactly what they were saying, but... Whether or not the state emphasized in its opening or closing its theory of the case doesn't change the fact of what the evidence is, notwithstanding the interpretation or spin the state's trying to put on it. And this jury easily could have concluded, notwithstanding what the state's saying, we don't agree with you that that's a prohibited sexual act or that he did that. We agree that he did something else. And there's no way that even the state's theory being articulated can change the fact there is evidence in there to support an interpretation that a particular juror may want to make.
All right, but I still don't have an answer to my question, and that is, was the state arguing more than one theory or only one theory?
It, as articulated in the state's answering brief in citing the prosecutor in her closing statement, she was arguing about the bets for nudity situation. That was her argument. And, of course, the jury is told the counsel of argument's not evidence, and you're free to disregard it. So that still doesn't change the calculus of whether or not the jury... There's a genuine possibility that the jury concluded on their own that masturbation was one of the things or that sexual contact was.
Explain, you probably have already done so, and I just didn't grasp it, Mr. Hurley, but what is the plain error that results from this situation?
The plain error is that instead of having a unanimous jury of 12 people who will say, yes, he, with regard to John Kenya, yes, John Kenya was caused to expose himself in a lewd, lascivious manner, his pubic area. Instead of having 12 people agree upon that to satisfy the Constitution, 9 of them said, yeah, we agree that, but we don't buy the rest of that, but we do buy into that conversation regarding masturbation is a prohibited sexual act. So you have 9 on one fact, 3 on another, as Probst was, the Miller shooting versus the Probst shooting. So when you get a mix and match as opposed to 12 people saying act number A, or act letter A, that is it, okay. Not A and B and some C.
And
too.
That's directly linked to the lack of specification in each of the counts?
That is correct. Okay. Because if it specified it in the count, to wit, we wouldn't even have to have a unanimity.
I think I get it now. Thank you.
The second argument that I make is with regard to the due process aspect, and that is simply that by using that broad language, given the time frame and given the fact that the juvenile says that something happened 25 times, the state brings up 8 counts of the 25 times of nudity, and assuming that the defendant was acquitted, because there is no specificity with regard to those 8 as opposed to the other 17, there would be nothing to prevent the state, if they lost, got a not guilty, to say, well, you know what? He said it happened 25 times. We only brought 8. We got 17 more to go after you again. And there's no barrier to stop the state from doing that. And ordinarily you would say, well, let's look at the trial record, because if all 25 were mentioned, we can assume that jeopardy attaches. But because of Pope and the intertwined 404 evidence, one could say, well, wait a minute. We brought up 25 to show this guy's intent, a pattern, an M.O. We weren't charging him with the 25. We only wanted to charge him with 8 because we were concerned that that would be overkill. And that's an argument that could be made and could not be refuted. So because, again, of lack of specificity, the defendant's right against double jeopardy to say every one of those 25 times that they allege has been taken care of by this trial. He can't say that.
Well, the lack of specificity could have been cured by a bill of particulars.
That is correct.
A bill of particulars wasn't...
That is correct.
...wasn't filed, so there's none in the record. Why isn't there a waiver argument?
Oh, there is, and then we get to the plain error. It's plain error. There should not have been a waiver. There should have been a bill of particulars filed.
We don't impute any tactical decision not to ask for a bill of particulars, that's the way in which the defense wanted the record to appear at the end of the day?
Interesting you asked that question, because I tried to search back in my mind, why wouldn't I ask for a bill of particulars? And sometimes I don't, because the more structure that a jury has when there's a lot of different acts, the better it is for the state. The less structure, the more it's just out there in terms of clouds, the better it is for the defense. I do not recall having that thought process at all. And
I understand why I asked the question.
Yes.
I mean, there's no more clever criminal defense attorney than you.
Well, thank you.
So being the cynic that I am, I have to ask you, was this part of a broader plan not to ask for specificity so the jury wouldn't see these specific instances of unlawful sexual contact and could get confused over the facts at the end of the day?
I can't in honestly say that wasn't part of it, because I don't remember. I thought about it today. There's nothing in my notes, but it's possible, because it's the other side of it is so clumsy that I ask myself, I can't miss that. First-year law student, first thing out of his mouth is, why are we doing this?
So my immediate thinking, to be fair with you and to alert the prosecutor, is you don't miss something like a bill of particulars. And then I look at the notes on the indictment, and it comes to me that perhaps you saw the police reporter talk with the prosecutor and filled in the gaps and believed you didn't need to ask for a bill of particulars because of that. But still, the net result is we are where we are with this cloudy, sketchy fact situation with no specifications in the indictment, and your argument that the jury picks and chooses and mixes and matches different sets of facts but reaches no unanimous decision on any single set of facts that would justify any single count in the indictment.
And what you say has such a, yeah, I would have to say that's probably what happened. Certainly I wouldn't have gone into a trial not knowing what I thought I needed to know in order to defend. So that is illogical, and it sounds like my thinking process.
Mr. Hurley, despite my relative age in comparison to you and to the Chief Justice, I am ignorant of the current practice, which you've alluded to, namely that we're no longer getting two-wit type clauses in indictments. If that's the case, I assume that's a practice that that pervades the entirety of the criminal prosecutions, not just prosecutions for masturbation. Is that correct? Or for unlawful sexual contact or whatever?
Yes. All they do is put in the statutory elements of the crime without two wits.
Why then have we not gotten these double jeopardy arguments in great multitude?
Well, I think
kind of, the kind of argument you're making now.
Because I would assume that the prosecutor and the defense would have some kind of discussion so everybody would be on the same page. And as you know, in our bar, we're very fortunate that there's communications and openness, and that's what happens in the vast majority of cases. I don't think I filed a bill of particulars in years and years and years. Simply you'll call up the prosecutor and say, okay, what are you talking about here? And this is an unusually complicated one because there's so many different acts over such a time span, and I should have protected the record better with regard to jeopardy. I didn't. But in the day-in, day-out mix, you get an indictment that doesn't specify. You get the police report, and the vast majority of time you can link it up because it's a discrete act, a discrete charge. It makes sense. In the event that there are several acts, any one of which could fall within the penumbra of what the indictment is saying, you pick up the phone and say, what are you charging in this particular case? And if there's any dispute on it, then you would make them formalize it. If there's not, you go, okay.
Well, even this indictment, though, has the charges treated differently. This unlawful sexual contact charges don't have specifications, but the others do within the same indictment, correct?
Well, there's no to wit. They mention names.
But they mention the details for the solicitation, but they don't mention details for the unlawful sexual contact.
That's true.
Or what I would call specifications for the
That's
charges.
True. So then what in this particular case with regard to unlawful sexual contact, I would have said to Mr. Roberts, what are you talking about there? And he'd say, touching his butt.
Well, okay. You better turn to your constitutional argument on the statute because you're running out of time.
Fine. With regard to the statute, the best way that I can explain the concern that I have with regard to due process and freedom of speech is a client coming to me and saying, I just found my 14-year-old child has masturbated. I've gone to our pastor, and he says that it's not immoral. I've gone to our doctor, and he says that it is physiologically normal as part of development. I want to tell my kid it's okay to masturbate, Mr. Hurley. Do you have any hesitation in the law? And I would have to say, yep, because I don't know if you can do that. And have to say, one could interpret this as you are causing, by giving the green light as a parent, you are causing or attempting to cause them to masturbate. And when they said to me, well, what does masturbate mean? I'd say, well, it means either touching somebody else in their genitals, having somebody else touch them, or touching themselves. It can be any one of the three. So the very fact that I can frame that question in candor and say I would have to say that allows me to say that men of reasonable intelligence and common sense have to say, state exactly what are you prohibiting here? And I believe that is constitutional infirmity.
So you believe this statute can be read broadly enough to make self-masturbation criminal?
No. If somebody is urging, importuning, or suggesting to a less than 14-year-old, they do it, that's criminal. The act itself is not criminal. The giving the advice or the persuasion to a 14-year-old is criminal, according to the broad reading of the statute, because masturbation includes self-stimulation. So if you just look at that literally, a dad says to a son, son, it's okay and normal. You do whatever you got to do, but you do it privately.
Or a psychologist or a medical doctor
Anybody.
Says to a patient, that's perfectly normal. That's also criminal.
According to what masturbation, the definition of masturbation, that's unqualified, unopposed definition. So the statute is too broad and far-reaching because nobody logically ever intended that result. But that statute says that. Thank you.
Well, just one question. I know I'm in your rebuttal, but is it conceivable under our method of operation to interpret the statute in a decision to exclude that possibility while preserving the balance of the statute?
I knew you were going to ask that. Ascroft talks in terms of a blanket, if there's unconstitutional, if there's an abridgment of free speech and the statute goes, to me, being honest, it's severable. You can knock out the masturbation number and go with the rest of it, and the rest of it is very self-explanatory and doesn't suffer from the same defect.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
May it please the Court, James Wakely on behalf of the State of Delaware. If I may, first, Your Honors, it is generally my practice not to use the name of minor victims, and I'll use initials unless the Court desires otherwise. This has never been a case about masturbation. It's never been a case in which it was alleged that Mark Howard tried to get J.K. or B.K. to masturbate. Mr. Hurley has apparently conceded the point as to B.K., but remains steadfast in his opinion that the basis of the charge was masturbation as to J.K. It has never been about that, And you can see that going back all the way to the beginning of this case, when Mr. Hurley alludes to a conversation he had with the prosecutor on the case, and I apologize, Your Honor, this is not in the record, however, in the prosecutor's file, and the state would be happy to supplement, there is a letter to Mr. Hurley dated December 15th, 2006, which is approximately 1 month after Mr. Howard is arrested, which says, I am prepared to present indictment on the following charges related to incidents occurring between December 2005 and August 2006. Victim number one, JK, 3 counts of sexual solicitation, the request to rub defendant's buttocks, to sit naked on a rock in Brandywine Park, and to look at, measure the child's penis. Victim number two, BK, 2 counts of sexual solicitation, swim naked in the Brandywine and drop pants so the defendant can check to make sure the victim is okay. The state would suggest that this letter, this conversation, this is why he never filed the Bill of Particulars, because it was clear on the face that this was not a case about masturbation. The charges at trial follow this. The prosecutor's opening statement makes no mention of importuning, soliciting the child to masturbate. The closing statement makes no mention of importuning, soliciting the child to masturbate. The discussion of masturbation and Mark Howard's conversation with JK relates to JK seeing Mark Howard masturbate in his presence. That is the conversation. That is indecent exposure. That is not sexual solicitation. And just to correct what may be a misapprehension, the charges of sexual contact here were specific. The charges relating to sexual solicitation were that he importuned JK and BK to expose themselves. Because this case has never been about masturbation, because there was no allegation, Mr. Hurley and Mr. Howard lack standing to challenge that here. And this court's jurisprudence is clear.
Can I stop you for a minute just so that I'm clear? In looking at the indictment for the sexual solicitation of a child counts, there's nothing in there that says that that it was just that it did not include the masturbation, right?
Yes, Your Honor. It quoted the language of 112A, which is a prohibited sexual act, which refers back to 1103 and the list of 12 factors there.
Well, the letter that you've just read to us, I gather, I'm not sure what your argument is about the legal relevance of it. Is it that, you know, if that letter had been entered as part of the record, it would have been had the same legal effect as a Bill of Particulars?
No, Your Honor. The argument goes to explain the fact that this was a tactical decision to present this argument here. As the cases interpreting the decision to challenge the indictment and why that argument must fail when presented for the first time on appeal make clear that this has to be viewed through the lens, through a colored lens, that this could be a tactical decision. To claim later, I didn't know what I was charged with, the state would suggest that that's a bizarre allegation from someone of Mr. Hurley's long and very well-respected history in this bar. And the reason he didn't do that is because he knew what the charges were.
Without purporting to speak for Mr. Hurley, my understanding of his argument is that even if the state did not do anything affirmatively to confuse the jury, by suggesting multiple scenarios that would have supported a conviction, nonetheless, that ambiguity was there. It was latent, in the case because of the number of incidents that were before the jury. If that's true, how does that impact your argument that Mr. Hurley was, you know, is in effect making a, made a tactical decision, you know, either at the time of the trial or now in terms of what he's chosen to argue on appeal?
If I may just clarify for my own purposes, Your Honor, if you're referring to the specific theory unanimity argument, whether this selection of events would have
that's what I'm referring to.
I'm sorry?
That is what I'm okay. referring to.
This court's jurisprudence in Liu and Probst are clear. The argument on all of these counts was that Mark Howard solicited these children to expose themselves for money.
When you say argument, you mean jury argument, opening and closing?
Jury argument, the evidence presented at trial. Yes, the indictment was not the model that we would typically wish to see. But all throughout the case, it was he solicited these children to expose themselves for money. It's in the statements from the children that were provided to Mr. Hurley prior to trial. It's in this letter provided prior to trial. This is clear throughout. This is what he's attempting to do. There was never any allegation of anything else.
I may have misunderstood the letter, which, of course, I haven't seen. But does it refer just to general areas that could constitute illegal activity but doesn't tie them in terms of time or date to any specific count in the indictment?
The time period, Your Honor, is the period of December 2005 to August 2006. No count is pointing specifically on this day he did this.
Well, that's really my question. There are multiple counts that could be addressed by one or more of those subject matter areas described in the letter, correct?
Yes.
But in the letter, none of those general subject matters are tied either as to the subject or the date linked to any particular count, correct?
I'm sorry, I may be misunderstanding what Your Honor is asking.
Well, let's say there's, I don't remember whether seven or nine, but let's say there's seven counts of unlawful sexual contact. The letter describes conduct that would constitute potentially unlawful sexual contact. But that general reference to what constitutes unlawful sexual contact is not tied to any specific count or any specific date on which it's supposed to have occurred, correct?
Your Honor, there were five counts, three to J.K. and two to B.K. The three counts were three acts that Mark Howard was alleged to have committed. Those are the three acts listed in this letter. The two acts to B.K., those are the two acts that he is alleged to have committed against that child. And just to be clear, Your Honors, the defendant was convicted of one count per child, and he also, during his direct examination, effectively admitted to one count against each child. In his direct examination, he admitted to the moon bet. He admitted to the skinny dipping bet against BK. Those were both in the record. And that's likely what the jury convicted him of. That is a solicitation of a child to perform a prohibited act.
Whether that's what the jury convicted him of or not, it goes directly to the plain error argument, doesn't it?
Yes. This has to be viewed through plain error. The fact is the jury was given a general unanimity instruction. Jurors are presumed to follow the instructions they're given. They convicted him of one count against each child. He admitted one count against each child, although he offered alternative explanations for why he did these things. He admitted one to each child. And so this is clearly not within the range of cases where a reversal on plain error grounds is appropriate. If the court has no further questions.
Just one, following up on the Chief Justice's question. You did, in response to his question, you've informed us that there were three separate counts against, with respect to one of the victims and two with respect to the other.
Yes.
Is it the case that none of those individual counts were specified as to a date? That is, it doesn't state that the conduct claimed to be criminal occurred on a specific date?
That's true.
That conduct occurred within some time within a period, correct?
Yes, between December 2005 and August 2006. The testimony at trial was more clear to the point that it was within the spring. Most of these events took place in connection with competitive mountain biking training, and that took place in the spring.
Okay, let me just try to pin down, at least for my own benefit, a little more clearly why you claim that this is not plain error. Is it because since the argument that was made by the state to the jury was consistent throughout, that is focused on one particular kind of conduct, then there would have been no reason for the jury to get confused?
Yes, Your Honor.
And since that's the case, and there's nothing in the record to suggest otherwise except a theory, that's not the stuff out of which plain error is made?
Yes, Your Honor. If there's nothing further.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
The letter that was referred to by my opponent was dated December 15, 2006, and this is within 2 months, 3 months of the disclosure. The indictment was returned on October the 1st, 2007, as is indicated in the record before this court. That's 11 months later. Certainly a preliminary offer in a letter does not suffice to say, for the state to say, this case has always not had anything to do with masturbation.
Mr. Hurley, I know you're short of time, but the last point Mr. Wakely made that still sticks in my mind that I think you need to address is the allegation that, or the suggestion that your client admitted two offenses, was convicted of two offenses, and therefore there's every reason for us to believe that that's fair and that can't possibly be plain error under those circumstances.
My client did admit that he offered money to Blaze to swim and skinny dip. The other admission I'm not so sure is a clear admission. He did talk about moon riding, and the answer is this. The jury is free to decide credibility of all witnesses, even a defendant. And I realize that's kryptonite for me, but I don't think it's lethal kryptonite. The fact that he, on the witness stand, said, yes, I did offer money for a kid that was already in water to swim across the water, doesn't necessarily mean that he is locked into saying, I committed a prohibited sexual act, so it's not fatal to our argument. And there is still the possibility, a genuine possibility, that the jury is focused on other things and not on that particular admission in reaching its decision.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.